You're listening to Flavour on Cambridge 105.
What sparked your passion for cooking?
I have a good appetite and I eat.
I'll often make subtle changes to the next batch of it.
As long as it has room to move around, it's classified as free range.
So my mother gave me a crash course in cookery when I was 16.
I remember sampling this amazing drink, thinking how I've never tasted coffee this good.
Which homemade desserts can be cheaper than shop-bought alternatives?
We want people to feel at home.
Good afternoon, you're listening to Flavour on Cambridge 105, the show about local food and drink with Matt Benman, Ruth Reyes and Alan Alder.
In today's programme, we talk to vintner Eugène Lismond, the owner of a new vineyard.
We discover the Sicilian delights of Café Aromi, opening very soon in the centre of town.
And we drop in on Gourmandise, a finely authentic French pâtisserie, ooh la la.
And spend an evening with a phoenix from the flames, the Cambridge Café project, where you can uniquely experience life from both sides of the counter.
Tom Lewis will be here with his selection of wines for April, and we'll have our regular review of food and drink articles from today's newspapers. So let's begin.
Ruth had the pleasure of speaking to Corinne of Gourmandise the other day, a self-taught French pâtissière. She sells her proper French pastries in a number of markets and at Balzano's in Cambridge. Ruth spoke about what she does with her, the difference between store-bought and the real thing, and where she's going.
So when did you start your company, Gourmandise?
When did I start Gourmandise? I started Gourmandise officially a year and a half ago, in October 2011. October 2011, I say officially because the administrative bit was done by October 2011.
Okay.
And then in November 2011, I officially started to sell because I started to the Impington Farmers Market near Heaston. So sales-wise, I started in November. And on the administration side, it was October 2011.
Okay, cool. So what prompted you to start?
What prompted me to start? I always had it in the back of my mind to actually start something linked with food, not necessarily pâtisserie at the time, because I like baking, but I like cooking in general, no matter what. I mean, give me a pan and and a spoon and I'll just, you know, I'll try to make something with it. Pâtisserie is just I was kind of a bit fed up by going down the shop and not finding something that I would probably find in France, like, you know, a proper tarte au citron or a proper tarte au chocolat. Although it had the name on the packet,
yeah,
it didn't actually taste like the proper product. So so I thought, well, why not start it myself, basically? So this is how it came about.
Cool.
So here we go, and here I am a year and a half later, basically. So
so do you have any experience with pâtisserie before?
I haven't got any experience. I'm not a pâtissier by trade. I've always loved baking. Basically, I started to bake when I had my first child 10 years ago. Because children like sweets, and I didn't always like buying the cakes from the shop, so I started to bake then, and I kind of like got hooked. Basically, started to buy some proper books, watching DVDs, watching cooking more and more baking programs on TV, and it all started like this, basically. So really, I'm a, how do you say that in English? Self-made pâtissier kind of thing.
Yeah.
So I learned all the technique by making mistakes. The taste was, most of the time, the taste was there. What was missing was the presentation, basically. So I had,
okay,
I really had to work on my presentation. So so here we go.
Nice. So where do you sell? What are the markets you go to?
At the moment, I sell at Impington Farmers Market, Great Shelford Farmers Market, and I am, since November 2012, but I started to sell also in Suffolk at in Wicken Vineyard Farmers Market. So I do those three every month now. Impington is the third Saturday of the month, and Great Shelford the fourth Saturday of the month, and Weekend Vineyard is the first Saturday of the month.
Okay.
So every week more or less I've got, you know, a market.
Okay, cool. And where do you think this will go? Are you going to do more markets or...?
No, I don't think I want to actually do more markets. There's two sides of the business, two or three sides of the business I've got in mind that I'd like to develop. One side is, because I don't intend to have a shop over the next 2 years.
Okay.
But I still like Gourmandise to grow as a business and grow as a name as well. In the Cambridge area. So what I'd like to do is to start selling a bit more to shops, cafes and delis, because not everybody has a pâtissier inside.
Yeah.
And there's one shop who's already selling Gourmandise pâtisserie in Cambridge, which is Balzano's Delicatessen on Cherry Hinton Road.
Okay.
Who have started selling my goodies since November 2012. And I'd like to develop that side of the business a little bit more.
Right.
And the other side of the business that I'm interested in as well is the wedding area, because the cake that I make are quite visually lovely to eat, but visually nice to look at as well. And for weddings, it's kind of the perfect combination. So I'd like to develop to get onto the wedding market. And then I did a wedding show in January, the Newmarket wedding show. So I'd like to develop that side a little bit more. And there's another side of the business that I'd like to develop because it represents how I started Gourmandise, basically, which is the cookery school. Just because, as I said at the beginning of the interview, I'm not a pâtissier by trade. I learned everything by, either watching video or reading books. And and basically, I just think that if I can do this, then I can probably communicate that to people. I think anybody can actually be a pâtissier if they give it a go.
Cool.
So I would actually love to be able to teach people what I learned myself, basically. So I think that would be good. And I've already started doing that actually, but with children, because I've got children myself, and I do a lot of baking with my girls. I do a lot of cooking, not just baking, actually. And I've got a group of children who actually come regularly to my house, and I teach them how to bake and how to speak French as well, actually, at the same time.
Wow, double!
So these are the three things that I'm really interested in. So selling to delis and cafes, the wedding market, and teaching people what I've learned by myself. So
okay,
here we go.
Perfect. So what kind of things do you sell? Give us a sample of what you'd have on a normal market day.
On a normal market day, I sell gâteaux, which are usually layered cakes that you have in French boulangerie. I also sell various pastries like tarte au citron, tarte au chocolat, and amandine. Amandines are basically pastries with fruit and a frangipane. And I also sell macarons. Here we go.
Cool. And so there you are. I look forward to eating more of those cakes. They were beautiful and delicious, and Corinne is a joy to speak to. Be sure to visit her at gourmandises.co.uk and follow her on Twitter at gourmandises1 for where she'll be selling next and what delicious treats she has in store.
You're listening to Flavour on Cambridge 105, community radio in your city. Coming up, we visit Café Aromi on Bennett Street, talk wine with Tom Lewis, and witness the reignition of a cafe community project.
Driving you home every weekday afternoon.
105 Drive with Julian Clover.
Cambridge 105. Right, I've got a message from Mark Hickford with the relation to my bicycle problems being stuck to the side of the house and by somebody else's bike on top of it. Mark's solution is a pair of bolt croppers if I want to borrow them. That could be interesting. If Sarah doesn't turn up shortly, that's exactly what's going to be happening to them.
Back Monday from 4, Cambridge 105.
Now, have you ever sat with a glass of wine and wondered what went into the making of it? I don't mean the crushing of grapes and the fermentation process. I'm talking about the establishment of the vineyard in the first place. How was the site chosen, and the grape varieties too, for that matter? And given the enormous number of different wines, Noel Young famously tastes about 3,000 in a busy week, how does a wine from a new unknown vineyard squeeze itself into the market? Alan?
Well, thanks to our wine critic Tom Lewis, I was able to find the answers to those questions through an introduction from Tom to vintner Eugène Lismonde, owner of the recently created Tour de Belfort vineyard in France. Eugène was on his way to give a talk to the Cambridge Food and Wine Society, about which more in a future programme. Eugène, you started up your own vineyard. Whereabouts is it?
The vineyard is very close to a town in France called Cahors. Cahors is in the southwest of France, roughly speaking, between Toulouse and Bordeaux.
Right, and it's spelled, for those who don't understand,
C-A-H-O-R-S. Cahors is where the famous black wine comes. We produce wine since 2009, so we have already produced three vintages.
Okay, and what sort of wines are they? Do you have reds, whites?
Yes, we produce a red wine, a white wine, and a rosé wine. And then we produce also a few grand vins. With grand vin, we mean wines which go only through new oak French barrels. And we also have two sparkling wines, a white sparkling and a rosé sparkling. In total, we have nine wines.
And what sort of grapes have you got?
We have a large number of grapes. On our vineyard, which has a surface of about 10 hectares, 25 acres, we have four grape varieties for the red, and we have four grape varieties for the white. Mm-hmm. As far as the red is concerned, number one is Malbec, which is the grape variety of the Cahors region, although most people think it is a grape variety from Argentina, but it was the French who brought over this grape variety over a century ago to Argentina. It is the birthplace of Malbec is in the Cahors region. So Malbec, then Cabernet Franc, which is the grape variety of the right bank of Bordeaux, and also Merlot and Syrah. So we have four varieties. As far as the white is concerned, we have to start with Chardonnay, followed by Sauvignon Blanc, very well known, Sauvignon Gris, a little bit less known, and also Sémillon.
There are some popular grape varieties there.
Yes.
Is that why you chose them?
No, we chose the best noble varieties suited to the soil that we have.
Well, I was going to ask you about that. When you choose the site, what sort of things do you have to look for?
Well, the first thing you have to look at is the quality of the soil. We don't want the soil to be too rich. We don't want heavy, greasy clay, which is perfect for wheat, but not good for wine, which needs a poorer soil, because we are looking for low yields. Mm-hmm. Because low yields means quality, because we get higher concentration. We look for good drainage. We look for fields, and therefore probably on slopes. We look for a certain height, so we get wind to dry out the grapes after rain, because we are fully organic, so we don't have any chemical protection against rot. We look for exposure to the sun, so that the vines are well exposed to the sun.
And is that why you like a sloping aspect?
Also, it is essentially for drainage, but also for the sun, right? And, these are the essential qualities that we are looking for.
I know it's important that you harvest the grapes at the right time.
Yes.
And I've heard it said, and I'm very interested to know whether this is true or not, that if you're harvesting them after heavy rain, the concentration's gone. Is that right?
Harvesting at the perfect maturity is the other big secret to getting good quality. Of course, if you harvest straight after the rain, the problem is that you have some more humidity on the grapes, and therefore you lower the alcohol percentage. It is not good to put wet grapes into the process. So usually winemakers like to harvest dry grapes.
Right, and so we're talking about sort of dry exteriors. It's the effect of the rain on the exterior makes the difference.
That makes the difference, yes. And we harvest only by hand. We only do hand harvesting. We don't harvest by machine, which allows us to select virtually every day the plot where we have the optimum maturity. So every day in September, we go into the harvest and we select the grape variety and the plot where we find the optimum maturity, and then we hand harvest the next morning very early at 6:30 in the morning to have fresh grapes, to have to cool and not hot by the sun. And so this selection of this maturity is extremely important to get good quality.
Are there many of you harvesting?
Well, we harvest usually with a team of around 15 people.
How did you choose the area? Did you look around a large area in order to find the one with the right characteristics, or what?
Well, choosing the area was rather obvious for me. I'm Dutch, and I married a French woman, very French, 50 years ago. And she is from the village of Belfort de Quercy, there where the vineyard is, very close to Cahors. We started 20 years ago by buying the chateau in ruin of the village. It used to be a bastide of the 13th century, and we started patiently restoring it. And over a 15-year period, we have restored virtually the whole old village, about half a dozen buildings. And then we built the winery at the foot of the chateau, and then we planted the vineyard on some of the land belonging to my wife's family.
You therefore had to start with new vines.
Yes, we planted the whole vineyard new in 2005.
There's a lot of work's been going into this.
Yes, but that was also part of the pleasure.
Yeah, but let's think about the reward as well. How easy is it for a new small producer to gain attention? Surely there's a lot of competition.
There is. It is very, very difficult. The problem is that, apart from the problem of overproduction that we have in wine in the world, the wine market is shaping towards a very simple two-model system. On the one hand, you have the supermarkets. They account for probably close to 80% of the sales, not only in this country, but it is the same in France and in Germany and in Holland, in the Benelux countries. This model works essentially on volume, and in this country very much for buy one and get two, or buy three and get five. So price and discount is here one of the main motivations. And then on the second model are the wines which benefit from well-known appellations, like Chablis and Sancerre and Côte du Rhône, or when you talk about other wines outside of France, Rioja, Chianti, and people then tend, or other big chateaus, of course, of the Bordeaux region and the Bourgogne region, and people tend to buy what they know, names that they know, especially if they're not very familiar. And when you are an independent, a small independent winemaker, without being able to fall into these two models, it becomes very, very hard.
And is being organic not an advantage, because there's less competition there, isn't there?
Well, we are organic right from the start. So we are, this is an organic certified vineyard. We make organic wines because we believe that an organic vineyard makes healthy grapes, and that healthy grapes are vital to get good quality. However, it is not the first main selling point. Our first main selling point has been the medals that we obtained as a reward for our quality. And after three vintages, 2009, 10, and 11, we obtained more than 10 medals, of which three gold medals in the Concours Général de Paris at the highest level. And these medals have helped us a lot to get awareness around our wine.
I bet they have. Something else I'm interested in, Eugene, is you talked about blending wines. How do you go about that?
Well, blending is one of our specialities, and it's part of our know-how of how to make quality wine. In fact, we, as I said already, we have eight different grape varieties. Now, we vinify them all separately in separate tanks or separate barrels, not together. And when the vinification is finished, and after a few months, probably around the January-February time, we will taste them all and we start blending in order to get wine with character. We want to make the wine to our personality. We don't want the wine to look like everybody else's wine. And blending allows you to make very personalized wines with a lot of character. And so we blend with a team. It's a whole team and also an outside analog, until we find the wine which we feel is the wine we want to bring onto the market. And we only use, therefore, the wines that go into the blend. The ones that do not go into the blend, we will sell off to the local cooperative, to be mixed with their own wine.
But do you know from experience that one grape will blend well with another? Or
oh, yes.
Is it experimental?
That was decided when we planted. So in other words, we only planted the grape varieties that we knew would blend very well together. Mm.
So where can we get your wines from?
Well, you mentioned how difficult it is to get yourself known in this market. So to find our place in this very difficult market, we have decided to go for the direct selling model. We only sell direct. We import our wine in this country ourselves, and we sell essentially through our website, www.tourdebelfort.com. With a few exceptions. One of the exceptions in Cambridge here is the Gonville Hotel, where you can enjoy the wine in the wine in the bar or over dinner, or get also a few bottles.
Oh, you can get it at the bar as well.
Yes, you can get it at the bar, the Gonville Hotel. You ask for Tour de Belfort wine, you can get it, and there are very good followers of our wine.
And is it wine that is suitable for just drinking without food that they've got there?
The white wine is very pleasant as an aperitif. The red would be better, of course, to go with the food.
Mm. But as you say, they have it in the restaurant there.
They have it in the restaurant, yes.
Yeah.
And we also opened up a shop in a suburb of Manchester called Hale, to be precise, where we opened a wine shop, a Tour de Belfort wine shop, but in an original way, with an original concept, because we are giving wine tasting and cooking classes in the shop in order to attract people and to do wine and food pairing. And therefore, increase the pleasure around our wines.
Very much a brilliant combination. And what's the price range?
The price range of all our wines is between £10 and £15. The most expensive wines are £15, the Grand Vin made in the oak barrels, and our sparkling rosé wine.
And that was Eugene Lismond of the Tour de Belfort Vineyard. And a reminder that the wines are on sale at the Gonville Hotel, and that the reds go nicely with food.
In Your Company is Cambridge 105's business programme, presented by me, Sam Davis. In Your Company tries to capture the diversity of the Cambridge business scene by talking to not only the high-tech headline grabbers, but also the sole traders and the startups and the experts who can help us make sense of it all. You can listen to In Your Company at 2 p.m. on Saturday afternoons every fortnight, and podcasts of all our shows are available on the Cambridge 105 website. Community radio in your city, Cambridge 105.
The pace of developments in the Cambridge food scene shows no signs of slackening. A Cambridge Bake Off is starting up with the final in the summer. The Cafe Project, as Matt reports on later, is starting to build momentum. There's a new Greek restaurant, the Olive Grove, at 100 Regent Street. Marrakesh has opened on the junction of Hills Road and Station Road. The Haymaker, in Chesterton, is opening later this month, someone said, as a gastropub. And ZZ is opening on Bennett Street soon.
And opposite ZZ and the Cow Restaurant is something, well, probably more interesting, Aromi, a Sicilian cafe. We visited it a while ago on Flavour when the building was just a shell, and things have moved on considerably. In fact, it's opening very soon, as Francesco explained to me when I went to see him and his wife Ophelia on Thursday.
We are opening next weekend, and we officially start in trading. We're going to go with a soft kind of opening, but officially it's next weekend, which we're very excited about. Our opening hours will be from 9 a.m. to 8 p.m. So we're going to stay open until a bit late, just to catch people. So when they finish shopping, before they go home, and they want to have maybe something nice to eat or a nice cup of coffee.
Or before they go to the theatre,
absolutely,
I guess, or to a music event. Yeah, that's great. And the place looks really different. You've got this lovely floor, you've exposed the brickwork, you've got tiles. What's the thinking behind that?
You know, we try to bring as many elements as possible from Sicily, and so we try to have a rustic but also modern contrast with the use of warm and fresh colours. So there is a mixture of whites, greeny, stony colours, but lots of use of oak and reclaimed oak, as you can see around in our counter, in the shelves, and also in our tables, just to bring that really rustic feel from Sicily.
The idea is really we wanted to bring as many Sicilian Sicilian elements as possible, you know, being Sicilian. Just to give an example, we brought the scale that we was first used in our coffee shop in Sicily in 1957.
Yeah, yeah. And, you know, as you can see, you know, most of the staff in the shop, they really bespoke. So we have designed these beautiful tables. We also brought our chairs from Italy, and probably the most beautiful touch has been added to these beautiful, you know, lovely tiles, which are basically undecorated tiles which have been brought from Sicily. And they have been widely used around the shop, as you can see behind the counter, but also in our beautiful staircase, which has been inspired to one of the most beautiful and famous Sicilian staircase in Sicily, which is called Scala di Caltagirone. So if you ever go to Sicily, you must see this beautiful staircase.
Well, it's a lovely mixture of wood and glass, isn't it? Which I think work very well together.
Yeah, and also hand-decorated tiles. Yeah, if we go downstairs, you'll see hand-painted tiles. Tiles which have actually been brought from Sicily. So yeah, it couldn't really be more authentic than that, couldn't it?
Yeah, that's the idea.
And downstairs here, which really was quite a sort of dark area, it's looking really nice, isn't it?
Yeah, basically the idea is to have obviously more seating downstairs, to have obviously a quite cozy element to the shop. We have also our kitchen where, you know, everything is kind of baked and homemade.
So everything is going to be baked homemade,
yeah,
is it?
As I say, when we say, you know, bringing a slice of Sicilian life into Cambridge, it's not just a tagline, we really mean it. Just to give you an example, we're going to have a good selection of breads, panini, but all our breads, all our panini are baked in the shop in the morning. This is just an example. Our pizza is homemade, home-baked in the shop as well. Patisserie as well. So we're really trying to do everything the Sicilian way, yeah, the authentic, yeah, way.
And most of our ingredients as well, they have been brought from Sicily. So fresh salami, fresh cheeses, they will all come from Sicily. Mm-hmm. So
your kitchen's going to be in big use then, isn't it? Because it sounds to me like you've got a lot of things that need baking or making there.
Indeed, yeah, it's all about organization, and luckily we have a lot of experience for that. We're literally bringing all the experience that we've been having since 1957. Lots of products, but luckily we also have the big oven,
yes,
upstairs, so we have kind of two main areas where all our products can be baked and produced.
Yeah. And what sort of things are you going to be making? You've mentioned bread, you've mentioned pizza, what's other sort of...
Yeah, as I say, breads is just one of them. Obviously, as I said last time, our, you know, delicious pizza, which is called Pizza Impala, which is slightly different to the pizza that you are kind of used in Cambridge. It's kind of longer, you know, I cut it in slices. It's very soft, very tasty, and very rustic as well. Then we have patisserie, obviously. We're going to have, you know, cannoli, your profiterole, your tiramisu, all of them, as I said, with a kind of a Sicilian twist. And then we also have arancini, most popular arancini. We couldn't open without them. The Italian community will be very upset otherwise. And lots of other products as well. But as I say, for a small shop, we cannot have the variety that we wanted to have because we are quite limited from the space, but we have a really good selection. But we want to make sure that whatever we do, it follows our recipes, quality, and hopefully people will recognize that.
You've used the word shop. That implies people can buy things here and take them away as well as eat them here if they wish, is that,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, that's correct. So not only the food obviously that we are going to make and bake in the shop, but we are going also to bring lots of like products, typical products from Sicily. So those products can be bought from these premises.
Right, what?
These being,
like,
you know, olive oils and lots of like chilies and oregano, lots of herbs, but also sun-dried tomatoes,
pestos,
and pestos, and lots of different creams.
Right, and these are all made in Sicily by what, small producers?
Yeah, in an artisan way as well. So they're not, you know, you can get those products off from supermarket and places like, you know, Tesco. But yeah, you can only get from local shops.
Is that going to make it a bit expensive, do you think?
It won't, not really expensive, not. So because obviously we are buying in euros, so the conversion in pounds will hopefully, help a little bit. But, you know, obviously people will understand the fact that these are artisan products, so, you know, you'll need to pay a slightly higher price, but not extremely high.
Presumably there's going to be some good Italian coffee. I saw the coffee machine upstairs.
Indeed. The good thing is you will be able to try some in a few seconds.
Right. And actually, it's going to be Sicilian coffee. Our brand, the brand that we are using, it's called Caffè Barbera, which is a brand that we have been used since 1957 back in Sicily. So that's the coffee that
sort of roasted in the Sicilian style.
It is. Absolutely. Indeed.
You presumably need to train your staff in making good coffee.
Indeed, that's obviously being Italian, coffee is an important element of the day. So for our staff, it will be very important to learn kind of coffee, almost the Italian way. Basically, mainly for espressos. For other coffees, it'll be easier, but for espresso, we really need to find the right balance. We need to check the humidity during the day because we need to adjust how the coffee is grounded. And just to give you an example, normally to get the best out of the coffee, the espresso should be ready between 20 and 25 seconds.
Right.
And if it's less than that, from Italian perspective, it's a bit too weak.
Because the water is coming through too quickly.
Indeed.
It's not picking up
absolutely
all the flavour.
Yeah,
right.
Absolutely. So
but what if it's slower than 25 seconds?
If it's over 30 seconds, then the coffee is overdone, so it's a bit burned, so it will give you like a bitter aftertaste, which is not exactly what we want.
Yeah.
So it's something that we will be monitoring.
And you can't just set that up at the beginning of the day and leave it like that for the rest of the day?
It depends on the weather. Normally not. Normally you need to adjust it once or twice.
Well, it changes in atmospheric pressure.
It does. Right. So normally you change it like once or twice day, so you realize it when you do the coffee, really. There's no other way until you actually make the espresso. You see, actually, no, this is not how it should be.
Right, so your customers will be watching to see that it's coming through in 20 to 25
seconds.
Yeah,
that's mainly for espresso, though. You know, for lattes, it's a bit easier, as I say, but that's mainly kind of for espresso.
Yeah.
At the beginning of that piece, Francesco said that Aromi was going to have a soft opening.
Yeah, it will open officially next weekend, but to get the staff familiar with everything, you do need to open gradually in a way. You don't want your staff to have to face a packed cafe for a full day immediately, so it's likely to have some unannounced openings before the weekend. Now, the coffee they gave me was not the Caffè Barbera that they're going to be selling. That's quite a pricey blend, and they didn't want it being used for staff training purposes. But what I had there was good all the same, and certainly superior to what you'd get in the big chains. But I was presented with some genuine Aromi Patisserie, and it is really good quality. It's absolutely delicious, in fact. Matt, I gave you a bit when you came round that night.
Yes, superior was exactly the word to give to it as well. It was so lovely and moist, but the consistency was like no other. I don't want to use the word sponge, but that's what it was, wasn't it? It was a sponge, but it had a different consistency to any other sponge I've ever tasted.
Yeah, it's quite soft, and the strawberries in it were really good flavour.
They were lovely. And what was the coating? It was almost like a cheese-like
coating. It was made from mandarin. We hear about it, I think, in the next
lovely,
extract.
Gorgeous, succulent squidgy.
Right, and what are these two?
Cannoli. Okay, so this is a chocolate cannoli, which is a very typical Sicilian pastry that we eat every Sunday, don't we?
That's correct.
So it's a tube pastry, which is fried and is filled with chocolate cream. But those tube pastries can be filled with any sort of like cream, can be mascarpone cream, can be pistachio cream, but the most famous one in Sicily would be ricotta cheese, which you actually we will be making them next week.
What's this one?
This is a rolle, which is, you know, sort of cake, which is filled with fresh cream and strawberries, and is topped with mandarin granella, I think, and icing sugar.
So that's why it's that lovely colour, orangey-yellow colour.
Absolutely. Yes, so and I think it's got a bit of liquor as well. into the mix.
Right, there's some cake arrived now. What kind of cake is this?
This is called Savoia cake, which is a very rich chocolate cake.
It's absolutely beautiful.
Thank you. Yes, it's basically, quite rich chocolate, and it's got lots of layers. It's got chocolate sponge and cream sponge with a hint of hazelnut flavour.
But look at the detail in it, these little balls.
Yeah, it's all hand-decorated, so all homemade.
Well, I think that looks fantastic, actually.
And I think the only thing left is for you to taste it.
Oh, well, let me.
There's a lot of it. It's dense, isn't it?
Yeah, it's very, very dense.
Wow, that's incredible. That's a lot of chocolate in that.
Yes, it's very rich, yeah.
Well, there's two chocolatey things here.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Both of which got a lot of chocolate. Is chocolate a big thing in Sicily, or is it just
It is. We have a city called Modica, which is popular around the world for making chocolate. And they make chocolate in so many different flavours. But having said that, we will have lots of fresh cream products.
We'll use a lot of mascarpone as well, and pistachio cream, and coffee cream. And plain patisserie cream, so there will be a lot of combination of cream there.
Fantastic.
But with going back to the cioccolata di Modica, which is Modica chocolate, we are also sourcing the chocolate itself.
Yeah,
so
we'll be selling some.
Our guests can buy the chocolate from our shelves.
Right. Well, it's certainly going to be worth coming here.
Absolutely.
So that was Ophelia and Francesco from Aromi, which is opening next weekend on Bennett Street and should be very well worth visiting.
You're listening to Flavour on Cambridge 105.
You know, Ruth, making your way in the world today takes everything you've got. But taking a break from all your worries, it sure would help a lot. Wouldn't you like to get away?
Just play the piece.
Okay, fine. The Cafe Project is a volunteer-run community cafe. It began 5 years ago. It's independent, not-for-profit, and non-alcoholic. It's also affordable, and it's open in the evenings. In fact, it's open as long as there are volunteers available, and just like Cambridge 105, the Cafe Project exists to encourage active community participation, something for us all to enjoy. Now, originally, the Cafe Project was located at 22 Jesus Lane, which is close to the ADC and the Friends Meeting House. And recently, it's experienced a brief period of hibernation, but now it's looking for a new place to call home. So if you're not into pubs and bars or chain coffee houses, perhaps you'd like to give the Cafe Project a try. Tonight is also a themed evening, a tea swap and free shop, where people can bring any food, any good quality things that they want to swap for someone else's. And that includes any freaky teas that you may have lying around, from your licorice and mint to your toasted walnut teas. And I'm here with one of the people involved, Philip Richards. Welcome to Flavour on Cambridge 105.
Hello.
Philip, would you like to tell us a little bit more about tonight in your own words?
Yeah, sure. As you said, not much had been happening with the cafe for a while, and we recently been getting together and having some meetings again. One of the things we thought we should do was have some actual events. Mm-hmm. So this is the first one of those, basically.
I'd like to explain the concept again, because it does sound quite unusual. I remember the first time I cycled past the front door of the community cafe. Obviously, the intention was you could go in there as a customer, but at the same time, you could also swap your role the moment you finished your tea or coffee and then start serving other people, which sounds quite mad, but also quite unique and very fun as well.
Yeah, I think a lot of it is about creating a space that anyone's welcome in and can get involved with. It's more of a community project, I guess.
Yes, yeah. The noises that you can hear going on at the moment is that Phil is just making...
I'm making some chocolate brownies. Vegan chocolate brownies, in fact.
Vegan
Yeah. Although I've never made them in this kind of tin before, so we'll see how it goes.
Got a couple of loaf tins.
Yeah,
there.
Yeah.
Gigantic brownies, I think,
yeah,
it's going to
exactly.
turn into. This is very good. There's lots of people here. They're just all busy making various things, including waffles. There's lots of tea going on as well. And one of the other interesting things is that you attract lots of other groups. The Cafe Project also had Transition quite heavily involved with them as well, I understand.
Yeah, well, I think Transition Cambridge basically ran one of the nights at the cafe every week, more or less, as far as I remember. I'm sure it changed a bit, but there were also lots of other groups involved at various times. And one of the kind of aims of it was to bring together different community groups in Cambridge could kind of overlap in a way that they might not do to otherwise. Mm. And I suppose especially between the university and town groups.
And I guess one of the main purposes of tonight, as well as the tea swap, is that it's also to raise the awareness of the need to get a new location for the project itself.
Yes, yeah, so I think running events is definitely something that gets people more interested and involved and excited about what you're trying to do, really. We are definitely looking for a more permanent space, which is quite difficult in Cambridge. Yeah, just the more the merrier, really. If you do stuff, hopefully people get involved with the things that you're doing.
Certainly. Now, also here in the kitchen tonight is Christy, who I've been speaking to for ages so far about robotics, of all things. He's making some awfully good waffles. This is a recipe you've not made before, yes?
That is correct.
How did you get involved with the cafe project?
Well, one day I was cycling along the road and I went past the store and it had a picture of a kettle on it. And I thought, this is quite bizarre. So I researched the name, found them online and wanted to get involved. We had some more meetings and we tried to get the whole project back up. Unfortunately, we couldn't find a new space. But this year we decided we are going to try and get everything back up again, and we wanted to do something as quickly as possible. We needed to make something happen, and this is what today is all about.
See, this is what the cafe project is all about. Some lovely hot waffles, freshly made, with lovely ice cream and blueberries and maple syrup. I'm just sitting here with Anna, a member of the cafe project, and also Transition Group Cambridge as well.
That's right, yeah.
But we didn't actually explain what Transition Group Cambridge do. Would you just like to give us a quick quote for any listeners who don't know?
Okay, so Transition Cambridge is about helping Cambridge make a transition towards more sustainable lifestyles, with a real focus on sort of practical things and also having fun and building community at the same time.
And as we tuck in, just on another complete side note, you have that lovely chicken cage that you just picked up. It's not a chicken cage, is it? It's a chicken-shaped egg-holding thing.
Yes, I think so.
Yeah, which was part of this whole swap.
Yeah, that's right. We seem to have lots and lots of interesting things. So we just invited people to bring things that they didn't want for other people to take away.
Yeah.
And we've got clothes and makeup, books and video game and all sorts of things that have just turned up. It's fantastic. And we've also, the other part of it was we invited people to bring all their old teas so that we could switch teas, because everyone's got teas in their cupboard that they don't really like. So,
yes.
And amazingly, someone brought these beautiful Chinese teas that they're like flowers. You put them in.
That was me.
Oh, they're just so beautiful. We just took some photos of it. When you put it in hot water, it opens up and it's...
They're great, aren't they?
So beautiful.
Now, Anna, one of the things we were talking about earlier was the fact that you're involved with something called Greeniversity. So we're just going to deviate slightly from talking about the cafe project. Would you just like to tell us about Greeniversity in terms of... You've got something coming up shortly, I understand, called a vegan cookery workshop.
Yes, these cafe projects, we've got three in a row. Hmm. And next week, we're going to have a sort of Skillshare, and there's going to be three Skillshares. There's going to be knitting and crochet, massage and vegan cookery. So Helen and Oscar are going to come along, and I'm not sure, they're probably going to do vegan cakes, maybe burgers or something. I'm not really sure what they'll make yet, but anyway, some vegan cookery for people to learn how to do it.
So everybody coming along, contributing their skills, no money changing hands, it's just one skill for another.
Oh, it's not even a swap of skills. You come along, so someone offers a skill and people come who want to learn it. And there's no money, as you say. It's just people who are passionate about things wanting to share with others who want to learn.
So the cafe project is going to host a variety of activities and events. It's used by several different community groups, and we hope it will be as well in future, as well as being a cafe, providing, say, a quiet, free, corporate-free space with tea and cake. It's also available as a focal point for meetings, discussions, talk, music, films, much more. They're always looking for volunteers and ideas. This is what's going to keep this project alive. So do check out their website and see how you can get involved. That's thecafeproject.org. You can also email cafeproject@cusu.cam.ac.uk. And of course, they have a Facebook page and a Twitter page. We'll provide links at the end of the program and on our podcast page. You know, I really love the sense of community and everybody contributing that little something of their own that evening, and the integration with the other community projects. In this case, we highlighted the Greeniversity and Transition Group Cambridge. You know, the spirit, it was palpable. Again, no money changing hands, just come along, have a lovely time, cook some food, have some tea, lots of banter, and meet new people. I thought I was only going to be there for a short interview, but I ended up staying the whole evening. It was very good fun. And there will be more cafe projects taking place on Tuesday the 23rd of April and Tuesday the 30th of April. So do get down there, if you can, to the Friends Meeting House on Jesus Lane. I'm pretty sure that's where they're holding them. And show your support for the cafe project. It is a very worthwhile idea. And I really hope that this piece will help make more people aware of it.
The Breakfast Show on Cambridge 105, a gentle way to start your Sunday. Relaxing music interspersed with hourly news to catch up with the stories locally and nationally. And traffic and travel for Cambridgeshire. A different guest reviewer each Sunday with the papers, a weekend sports roundup, and guests after 10 reflecting local organisations and services. Join me, Phil Rowe, from 8 this Sunday on Cambridge 105, community radio in your city.
And you're listening to Flavour on Cambridge 105. You can keep bang up to date with Cambridge's food news by following Flavour on Twitter, at Flavour105, and if you have news you think that we should feature in the upcoming episode, you can email us. Our address is flavour@cambridge105.fm. And now we welcome back to the studio Tom Lewis, who's going to give us his wines of the month for April.
And Tom, before we go into the wines of the month for yep. April, you know, we were talking to Eugene Lismond on the, okay, on the yep. programme, and I was wondering, what's going on in vineyards at the moment?
Well, if we look outside, it's sunny, it's warm. I mean, this is the start of the 2013 vintage, and the wine that will become 2013 wine is just beginning its life. It's starting to burst through as buds on the vines.
Yeah. Oh, right. OK, so this is the moment. OK, well, for the wines of April, I know you quite like to sort of stick with, you know, whatever events are coming up. And there
Absolutely.
Is St. George's Day, isn't there?
Yep.
And it occurred to me that St. George, well, it's a couple of things about St. George. One is he was born in what's currently called Turkey, or it's some
yep.
time been called Turkey. So are you doing any Turkish wines?
Not Turkish wines this month, right. But that is an up-and-coming region. It's something we could certainly look at.
Right, OK. But he was also the patron saints of shepherds as well.
Yep.
So have you got any that will go with lamb, perhaps?
I think lamb should definitely be on the menu for St. George's Day.
Yeah.
But given how unpredictable the weather's been, I've gone for a bit of a mix of all eventualities of wine, so I hope we'll cover all bases.
Right. Now, one thing I can't help but have noticed, Tom, you know, because I'm nothing if not unperceptive, you tend to go for red wines.
Well, we've been doing a lot of reds in the cold weather.
Ah, right.
As it starts to warm up, then we'll look for lighter wines.
Yeah.
And we'll start to bring the whites out over the summer.
So any whites today?
I'm going to start with a white. My first one, it's the Bodega Mengoba Brezza Blanco 2011. This one's from Joseph Barnes Wines, and it's £11.35. So first of all, we're in Spain. We're in the region called Bierzo, which is in the northwest. Now, the grape varieties here are local to this area. They're Godello and Doña Blanca. And the vineyard is at an altitude of about 550 metres.
OK, and what effect does the altitude have on the wine?
Well, 550 metres is quite high in terms of altitude, and the higher we get, the cooler it is. Mm. So what that will do is extends the growing season, so we'll get more freshness in the grapes, but there'll also be more depth of flavour. There's plenty of sun, but there's the coolness, so they take longer to ripen.
Mm.
And I think there's certain characteristics you get from wines at altitude that you can taste in the wine. The other thing you'll notice about this one, it's aged in large old oak foudres. So there is a bit of a subtle oak influence in there as well. So in the glass, it's quite pale. It's very fresh, but it's also got a roundedness to it. On the palate, there's tropical fruit, and the finish is quite lingering.
Right. That's not the area of Spain you're from, is it?
No, it's not. I'm from Madrid. That's where I was born anyways. And my family's from the north in Asturias, and my grandfather's from Cuenca, so that's near Madrid as well.
Right, okay. Now, the next wine, Tom, an American wine, but not from California.
That's right. Most of the US wine is made in California, but this one is from Washington State. It's Columbia Crest, Two Vines, Cabernet Sauvignon, and that's $6.99 from Bacchanalia. Now, Washington State, it's much further north than California, and so it has a much more moderate climate feel as a result. This one has lots of bramble fruit, freshness, and some spicy toasty oak in there. It's medium-bodied, so that means it's fairly light for a red. It's got a soft feel, and it's quite harmonious. What I think makes this really interesting is there's a savouriness there and a firmness on the finish. The way I'd like to sort of summarise the wine, in terms of an analogy, it's a handsome, well-groomed All-American. If you think of Richie Cunningham from Happy Days, yeah. then that is this wine.
Right, well, this idea of summarising or summing up a wine through comparing it to a person is quite an interesting one, isn't it? So I wonder if one day you might come along and say this wine is very Maggie Thatcher.
Maggie Thatcher. Well, it's funny. There was one I did this morning. I was tweeting someone about. I likened it to Joanna Lumley. It was very beautiful, and as it gets older, it the age increases, but the beauty just stays there. So
very nice. What would you say about a John Major?
A John Major wine? Oh, probably something sort of slightly bland. Really, that's how it always was on Spitting Image.
Yes. Right, this American wine, this one from Washington State, yep. Readily available?
Well, it's from Bacchanalia, but it is a bin end, and that sort of is reflecting the price. It's probably cheaper than it would normally, if it's generally available. What it means is it is available in limited quantities. So if you like the sound of Richie Cunningham as a wine, then you need to get down to Bacchanalia fairly quickly.
Right, OK. Now, the next one you've got is a rosé, but... You know, it's pretty chilly today, a bit early for rosés.
It is a bit early to be starting on the rosés. This one is more, I would call, a red wine without tannins than a full-on rosé. So I would serve this only slightly chilled. It's the Magpie Estate, The Thief, Mourvèdre Grenache Rosé, and that's from Noel Young Wines, and it's $11.95. And this is from Noel's own vineyard in Australia.
So Noel makes wines as well as selling it?
That's right. He has a joint venture in the Barossa Valley, and his winemaker out there is Rolf Binder. So Noel's based in the UK, but then he travels out to the winery for the blending of the wines before bottling.
Mm. Well, that could be the subject for a future programme, actually, talking to Eugène Lismond about blending. I thought it was quite interesting, and actually I wished I'd asked him more about it, so perhaps we could ask Noel about blending.
Definitely, yes.
at some point. Anyway, tell us more about the wine.
Well, this is made from a classic Languedoc grapes, Mourvèdre and Grenache, and there's a touch of Cabernet Franc in there. Now, in the glass, it looks like cranberry juice. It's that dark, translucent red. And as you sniff, there's a bit of smoky spice and some soft red fruits. On the palate, there's more soft red fruit. It's very mouth-filling, and it's got a savouriness that means it'll match really well with food. Sort of foods I'd have with this are classic picnic food, something like cold meats, and I think it'll stand up really well to spicy food with tomato in.
Right. From what you've said, that's a fairly young wine then, is it?
It is quite a young wine, yes, but it's as I say, it's got the savouriness on it that I think it'll make it a very food-friendly.
Yeah, right, OK. And a wine suitable for a barbecue since we're moving into that season?
Absolutely. If it gets warmer, we could certainly have a barbecue. This one is a Wine Geek's Barbecue Red. And what I mean by that is it's good, it's a crowd pleaser, it's a good quaffer, but it is actually really well made. It's La Camisa Malbec 2012, and it's from Mendoza, and that's £8.50 from Cambridge Wine Merchants. So as I said, it's an Argentinian Malbec from Mendoza. And Matt, we were talking earlier about altitude. Mm. This one, the vineyards for this one will be somewhere between 700 and 1500 metres, so much higher than we get in Europe. But in South American terms, that's actually fairly middling. And the region of Salta, they start at 1,600 metres and go up beyond 3,000 metres.
Okay.
Now, the typical characteristics of Malbec are it's usually a little bit rustic. It certainly has a very outgoing sort of personality. It's not well-groomed like our American red. It's more of a cowboy in leather chaps.
Is it a Ronald Reagan?
Could be. Ronald Reagan. It's fun, but it's not subtle. So this one has a lot of Malbec typicity. There's smoky spice, there's ripe plummy fruit, and lots of black cherry. But it is well behaved. There's a freshness and a savouriness there. It's well made. And the tannins on it are perfectly ripe, so it feels very smooth and very mouth-filling. This would be a perfect match for smoky barbecue meats or a peppery steak.
Right, well, that sounds pretty good. Tom, I don't suppose everybody remembers the names of the wines. Is there somewhere on your blog, perhaps, where
you've got them? If you look on my blog, Cambridge Wine Blogger, and click on Wine of the Month, then all the names of the wines will be there.
Right, okay.
Cool. Well, thank you, Tom. And next time, could you come back and explain a bit more detail the couple of terms you use quite often, actually? Crowd-pleasing wines and wines for geeks.
Absolutely. Being a geek myself, I'm happy to talk about it.
Serving our city and the surrounding areas.
We are Cambridge 105.
OK, now we move on to our regular newspaper feature. So what's caught your eye this week, Alan?
Well, last time I did this, the Financial Times had a Sicilian food issue, which was
incredibly impressive, and I've kept it. But there are slimmer pickings today. Roly Lee's rigatoni with artichokes and bacon roll in the Financial Times would make a nice light meal, though. And there's a Tim Hayward article in the same paper about, well, really the idea of authenticity and whether it's possible also to create historical dishes accurately. The Janice's Robinson column, which is headed Slim Pickings, is actually about the 2012 Bordeaux vintage. So that tells you a little bit about the Bordeaux vintage from the headline alone. But in terms of culinary voyeurism, well, does The Guardian have any more to offer? Certainly food is dominant on its masthead on the front page with an advert for its food section, Cook. In fact, I think there's pictures of both Hugh Fearnley Whittingston and Yotam Ottolenghi up there. And it seems to me there's a battle going on with the Times with food as the weapon. Inside, some useful ideas for those who agree with Fergus Henderson's philosophy of eating the whole animal. More about that in a minute. Yotam Ottolenghi talks about fritters, amongst other things. The Cook section has the, well, it has the 10 best sandwiches. Any thoughts on what you'd put in your 10 best?
Well, it would only go back to childhood sandwich mixes that I used to enjoy. Things, obscure things like sandwich spread and pickled onion mixed in together and so on. But I was always very envious of American-style sandwiches. There are all these flavours and words that sounded so exotic to me, like pastrami on rye and so on, so on, so on.
Yes.
And I guess you've experienced an awful lot of that, Ruth.
Oh, they're so good. I love pastrami on rye. And then there's also the famous PB&J, peanut butter and jelly sandwiches.
Yes.
Very popular. Yeah. I love it. It's right. So good.
Right. Well, if you've got time, I'll reveal some of The Guardian's top 10. But also in Cook, Dan Leopard bakes with ginger. And Ruth, you'll be interested to know there's a piece about making hot chocolate Spanish style, which I guess is something you like.
Yeah, I love it. So good.
Yeah, and so different from
very much so
other hot chocolate.
Better for dipping.
Right. onwards. Readers send in their recipes for crunchy things, including, believe it or not, crunchy ice cream. There's an article about crabs that includes the recipe by Rosie Sykes of Fitzbillies for spiced baked crab. But back to Hugh Fearnley Whittingstall. In the preamble to his recipes for deviled kidneys on toast, poached tongue with white beans and parsley, paprikash of hearts and livers, he talks about his offal manifesto. He says, if you eat meat, the idea of eating liver or tongue is all the same. It's flesh and blood. And he feels that's what we, what should make you feel queasy, if anything, is the preponderance of lean steaks and skinless, boneless chicken on the shelves of shops. And he says it always makes him think, where's the rest of the animal gone? Are you into offal, you two?
Not particularly, but I suppose it's the associations that we all form from various countries that determine whether we find something detestable or not, whether regardless of its quality.
Right.
I can't say I've ever had it.
Oh, really? Right. No. Okay. Well, I eat a reasonable amount of offal, but I did decline in Marrakesh stuffed spleen. I thought that was going slightly too far.
My dad used to eat brains and faggots and things, you know, and I didn't. Right. I've never really wanted to try those things.
Well, maybe we'll bring some in. Yotam Ottolenghi talks about pairing fruits with spices. He talks about notes of cloves in a banana. I mean, bananas go brilliant with cardamom, for example. He talks about flavour combinations with pineapples too. In the Financial Times, Tim Hayward's article about recreating historical dishes leads him to criticise the notion of authenticity. What is an authentic Indian restaurant? What is authentic Indian food given its enormous diversity? In India, are there authentic European restaurants serving fondues, egg and chips, paella and smorgasbords? Back to the Financial Times on wine. Janice Robinson says the 2012 vintage in Bordeaux has been a very challenging year, not because of the Merlot grape, but because of the Cabernet Sauvignon's ripening was affected by the late season. The wealthiest vineyards could deploy enough people to snip off excess crops. So the top red Bordeaux's are fine and cost into three digits for each bottle. And the more cash-strapped Appalachians have had a hard time, though. But she does give a few recommendations. Right, would you like to know about the best sandwiches?
Oh, just very quickly.
Okay, a three cheese toastie, an egg sandwich, torta de carnitas. The article says Mexican tortas are the most interesting sandwiches in the world. A rye bread sandwich that includes strawberries, banana, yogurt and honey. It's called the Wimbledon. Beetroot and radish with English mustard, tartine with walnut, lemon and ricotta, pesto and sautéed mushrooms, and so on. But also a Reuben, which we might be able to get at the Fitzbillies pop-up on Ruthie.
The 1st of May, actually, I think.
First of May.
Yeah.
Which is a sort of New York deli night. It sounds great. So that's the food in the papers for today.
Thank you, Alan. And that brings us to the end of another show. Many thanks to all of our interviewees. Corinne Paillet of Gourmandise French Patisserie, vintner Eugene Limond, Francesco and Ophelia Genovese from Café Oromi, Philip Richards of the Café Project, and Cambridge Wine blogger Tom Lewis.
You can email us at flavour@cambridge105.fm, and don't forget to follow Flavour on Twitter, @flavour105. That's where you'll read about the news we discover ourselves, and also we retweet other food and drink stories from other sources in Cambridge.
And the next live edition will be Saturday, the May the 4th at midday. You can find our previous episodes on our podcast page on the Cambridge 105 website. Coming up next, Saturday lunch with Davina and Scratch.
Okay, goodbye.